This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. 75 years ago brought the publication of one of the most influential books of the 20th century. It sold over 30 million copies, and it's changed the lives of millions of people around the world. I'm talking about what's known as the Big Book. The official title is Alcoholics Anonymous, the story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. It was written by the co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, Bill Wilson, Bill W. I'm joined now by Dr. Howard Markel, who's director of the Center for History of Medicine at the University of Michigan. Dr. Markel, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
As you consider historic moments in medicine, where does this Big Book stand in your view?
It's huge. It's huge. You know, every author has the fantasy, generally when they're writing their book early in the morning or late at night, that people are going to actually buy and read and get something from their book. And this book has had, as you said, 30 million copies. That's a lot of copies. And it is still as relevant today as it was 75 years ago. It was published April 10th, 1939. And not only has it been influential because people have read it, but they have taken the principles and tenets to heart. The most successful have recovered from the debilitating disease, alcoholism. And versions of that book have been recast for the big books of Narcotics Anonymous or Gamblers Anonymous or what have you. So all the 12-step programs that we know about, Overeating Anonymous and on, have all used the AA Big Book as its source.
And thinking of this man, Bill Wilson, the name that is forever linked with Alcoholics Anonymous. But can you tell us about him? Like, what was his background, and how long did he struggle to get sober?
Well, Bill Wilson, or Bill W., as he was known, mm-hmm. because it's Alcoholics Anonymous,
right.
was the co-founder of it. He was a remarkable man and had quite the ego as well. He was a World War I vet. He came back to the United States and lived in New York. He married a lovely woman named Lois Wilson, and he was interested in the stock market. And he – this is before the crash.
Okay.
He had the novel idea of checking out companies that you should invest in by actually going to the companies, going to their factories, being an undercover agent, if you will, and seeing how these companies work. And then he would write his colleagues in New York, you know, this company is a good one, this one is not, mm-hmm. this is well managed, and so on. But he began drinking very early on as a young man, probably before he was even a soldier in World War I, but that's where he really started it.
And I imagine many young soldiers did come home with that.
Yeah, and you know, problem. There is this, we didn't know about it then, but there is this predisposition to alcoholism, probably genetic, that, and you can kind of tell those people that on their first time out, they go really out there.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time in the 1930s, when he had lost his business and was really living on his wife's salary as a department store clerk, and they were living in his father-in-law's house in Brooklyn, he was quite the two-quart-a-day rot-gut alcoholic. He was quite destitute. They lived in a brownstone in Brooklyn, and he put a mattress out on the sidewalk by his window in case he jumped. So he was so despondent, so depressed. And he had gone to the equivalent of rehab hospitals mm-hmm. a number of times. There was a hospital on Central Park West. It was called the Towns Hospital, owned by a man named Charles Towns. And it had a cure, so-called cure for alcoholism. It was something called the Belladonna cure. And you took copious amounts of Belladonna.
Which is a poison.
It is a poison.
Okay.
It will also make you hallucinate. And by the way, withdrawing from alcohol will potentially make you hallucinate.
The DTs,
and being an alcoholic might make you hallucinate. So he had gone there several times, but the final time he went, the fourth time he went, he had had a lovely meeting with an old drinking buddy, a guy named Ebbie Thatcher, who is forever recorded in the annals of Alcoholics Anonymous history. And Ebbie had found religion. He had joined a Christian group called the Oxford Group. And through that – and the Oxford Group was a big movement of Christianity in the early 20s and 30s. They had four absolutes, absolute purity or chastity, mm-hmm. Honesty, unselfishness, and love. So those are the four absolutes. And he took Bill to the Bowery Street Mission, where there were a lot of drunks, you know, the famous Skid Row of New York City, and talked to him quite a bit about it, but Bill wasn't really interested. Shortly after he went to the town's hospital, was being heavily dosed on belladonna, pyraldehyde, a number of other sedatives, and he had this moment, this famous spiritual awakening that he writes about, where he saw a light. He said, you know, God, if there is a way out of this, help me. And that was the spiritual awakening that he writes about that he urges on all alcoholics to have. It's complicated.
It's the hitting bottom.
It's hitting bottom and then actually in some way seeing a higher power, that something can get you out of this beyond yourself. Mm. And it's been interpreted many different ways. And some people's spiritual experiences are different than others. Some might be in increments that you just see that things are getting better. Mm. His was quite dramatic. And whether it was a hallucination or real, doesn't really matter.
Because it did the job.
Because it did the job. And so he became very interested in, you know, he was a very enthusiastic man, and he wanted to help other alcoholics. And he tried using the Oxford Group tenets. But the Oxford Group tenets really were very mired in their religious faith, and that didn't work out so well. So he started his own group a few months later, about 6 months later, when he was on a business trip to Akron, Ohio. And there he was in Akron, and he was newly recovered, about 6 months sober. And he was in a hotel lobby, and he could have gone to the right where there was a lovely bar and people are drinking highballs mm-hmm. and champagne and beer and having a great time. Or he could have – there was a bank of phones and a directory like there used to be in hotels of all the various churches and the ministers and the priests and so on who ran each church. And so he just started going through and called each minister or priest, do you have a drunk I could talk to? I'm a recovering alcoholic. I think I need to talk to another drunk. And that's where the idea of only another alcoholic can help an alcoholic or an addict can help an addict because they understand the bottom, as you refer like no other person. And it also was it's a brilliant move because by talking to that other alcoholic, you are actually helping yourself.
There you go.
You know, it's a really a dual therapy there. And one minister said, well, you know, there's a doctor. He's a well-known surgeon, Dr. Bob Smith. By the way, he got kicked out of the University of Michigan Medical School.
Did he? Bob Smith.
Yeah. We don't see his picture on the walls at the University of Michigan Medical School. But he was a surgeon who was quite a drunk. And he had been also a member of the Oxford Group, and nothing worked. And the two met. They hit it off. Dr. Bob said, this guy really knows what I'm going through.
Huh.
You know, that identification of another person.
An aha moment.
Right. Yeah. Right, right. And so the two of them became very enthusiastic and started working one at a time, first in Akron and then elsewhere, New York, with other alcoholics trying to help them. And think about it. Two guys come to a hospital room on the drunk ward and said, we're going to help you. They must have been, you know, thought to be crazy.
Yeah.
And but they worked it out as they went along. And over the next 3 years, they came up actually with six steps, not 12 steps.
The 12 steps that we know today really began as six.
Right. Okay. And they were – they're really an abbreviation of the 12 steps. So you admit that you're powerless over alcohol, which is still the first step.
Mm-hmm.
We got honest with ourselves. We got honest with another person in confidence, which is still the fourth and fifth step.
Mm-hmm.
We made amends for harms that we did to others, which is the eighth and ninth step. And we worked with other alcoholics without demand for prestige or money. That last part is critically important. It was never about money. It was never about professionalism. They were tempted at many points, as was Bill W. tempted.
Yeah.
And I think that lack of being part of the American medical establishment or the recovery establishment, which we now see, really, really was critically important. It was not about money. It was about helping other people. And then there was we prayed to God to help us to do the things as best we could. Now, while they wrote those six steps, Bill decided in a – you know, and he was – as I said, he was a very impetuous, enthusiastic, must have been a pain in the neck kind of guy. And he decided, well, you know, these steps are too general, and he within 30 minutes wrote the 12 steps that we you can look up.
Yes.
But in the original iteration of the steps, because he was a deeply religious Christian, there was a lot of talk about God. So there was, you know, it's only by appealing to a God that we could get this lifted off of us. And in one step, the original fifth step, he said, we urge you to kneel before God and pray for
And where does that leave the person who isn't so sure about God?
Exactly. And so there were other groups of AA in Akron, New York, and so on. And the writing of the big book, even though Bill Wilson is on the copyright form, if you look up the Library of Congress copyright, it says, you know,
yes,
William G. Wilson. It was written by many people of the original members. Most of them had about a year and a half sobriety. So these were not, you know.
Yeah, they weren't long timers.
No. Yeah. But that was it. So they wrote it. And there was one member who said, you know, I really don't like this God stuff. He was an agnostic. And there is a famous chapter in the big book called A Chapter to the Agnostic. And the idea that he introduced was that, well, all you have to do is believe in something bigger than yourself. That's where the higher power comes from.
Whatever it is,
right.
That works
it can be
for
the
you.
Spirituality of the group. Some people think it's something else, you know. And there are people who do believe in God. There are those others who don't. But that substitute of religion, organized religion as we understand it, for spirituality, of a sense of something greater than yourself, really saved the day. And in fact, there were earlier groups for alcoholics, like the Washingtonians in the 19th century, and the Oxford group that were so connected in that case to the Christian faith. Because what if you believe in God but you're not Christian?
Sure.
Or Jewish or
sure.
Muslim or what have you. So that separation, this believing in something else, was a stroke of brilliance. And the fact that Bill W. could back off on his own very enthusiastic ideas was his own, I think, brilliance beyond coming up with all this. And so it was very much a group effort, and then the 12 steps were developed and became part of the big book in 1939.
So it was without agenda. It was without personal gain. Here you are. I want to help you.
Yeah.
So the purity of it, when you think about the reason behind the writing of the book and forming the Alcoholics Anonymous, and here it is speaking to people 75 years later just as strongly as it did in 1939.
Yeah. And, you know, when – you can imagine when there was only a handful of groups.
Yes.
The only way to spread the gospel, if you will, was to write a book. And even though now there's hundreds of thousands of groups all over, 170 or more countries, and there's millions of members, that book is still the ambassador to not only every newcomer but every old timer. And there are parts of the book that are quaintly dated. For example, they refer to alcoholism as an allergy because that was a metaphor that made sense in 1939. Okay. But if you get – and some of the writing is somewhat stilted, frankly.
So it has not been updated, edited?
Well,
the
first 164 pages are the original 164 pages. Then there are the stories of strength, hope, and experience by members telling their own story that is updated at various intervals.
Okay.
So, for example, the original stories were all probably white men. And so in order to have, you know, diversity of minority candidates and so on involved, women alcoholics. You know, that was a long trudge in and of itself to have women members of Alcoholics Anonymous. So that has evolved. But the original 164 pages is pretty much the same as it was in 1939. And if you look at – they have actually published the manuscript. You see all the little handwriting. You know, we believe that this should be changed to this or to that. So it was very much a group effort. And when I – having been at the University of Michigan for many years, you can't get a memo that's been written by 10 people, let alone a book. So the fact that they all stuck together and these were people of, you know, very strong opinions – and produce that book makes it all the more miraculous.
You know, you think about it, Dr. Markle. As a physician, do you find yourself thinking of the sheer number of lives this book has saved in the decades?
Yeah, that would be a wonderful study to do, wouldn't it? You know, alcoholism has a very high what's called recidivism rate. So within five years, many people relapse. And it's a relapsing disease. You know, it's funny. If somebody has diabetes and they need a new insulin dose, we don't call that a relapse or a failure, but we do with alcoholism and addiction. But it has saved countless lives. You know, it would be interesting to do a study if you could design one. And also, you know, it was a non-medical approach, and it remains non-medical. Now, a lot of addictionologists and people who study alcoholism and addiction have embraced that, but that took a while. And in the late 30s, early 40s, when the medical industrial complex was very different than it is today,
yes.
This was very much looked upon as, you know, sort of a layperson's thing, you know, and it wasn't given the credibility that it has today.
And here today, we do have a real sense of the spiritual as being a part of the healing process
yeah.
that did not exist then.
No, I mean, 1939 is really the height, the zenith of the scientific, the mm-hmm. golden scientific era of medicine. Whether they had the science or not, it was that science was going to carry the day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a great novel, Aerosmith, by Sinclair Lewis,
which
is a Michigan story in and of itself.
Yeah.
But his prayer is, God, give me faith not to believe in God. So this mm-hmm. this whole notion of separation from the scientific, the quantitative, what you could see, smell, and hear from the spiritual. We've actually changed quite a bit since the 1960s and 70s and 80s. And this mind-body connection
yeah.
and a connection to something bigger than yourself is something that's taught down the street where I work and was not taught so heavily when I was a student there in the early 1980s. So we have learned, the medical profession have learned, that there is more to healing than just what we write with our prescription pad or what we dissect with our scalpel.
A fascinating conversation. Dr. Howard Markle, who is the George E. Wants Distinguished Professor of the History of Medicine at the University of Michigan and Director of the Center for the History of Medicine, looking at the very, very significant 75th anniversary of the big book that has been giving alcoholics hope for all these decades. Thank you so much.
Thank you.